History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We really want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, you're going to hear some interesting stories. We might hear from two different people. But ladies first, we're going to start with someone who had a very important role in World War II that you don't hear that much about. Have you ever heard of a Rosie the Riveter? Where you're going to meet one today in Clovis, California. Angie Schiappi is 95 years old, but she tells me she can remember back to when she was 3. So when you were 3, what was going on in your world? Where were you and what was life like?
All right, we lived in Pittsburgh, California, and my mother had, at the time that I was about 3, there was only 5 children. But my grandma lived with us, and my grandpa and my aunt and uncle, because things were very poor then, and, you know, it took a lot of money to feed all those kids and all those people. And my mother was a sick lady. She had epilepsy. Mm. So my grandma took care of all of us. So as we grew up, I got real attached to my grandma. I went everywhere with her, everywhere. My father worked at the steel mill, wasn't making too much money. My mother made good meals, made them last a long time. No leftovers. And we were a happy family. Of course, I didn't know any better, no different, you know.
And your parents had both immigrated from Mexico.
Yes.
So when you talk about your mother's cooking, I've got to hear what was the best, because we live here in the San Joaquin Valley. There's a lot of good Mexican food around here. What did she make?
She used to make homemade tortillas, rice, beans, enchiladas, tamales, you name it, everything. And I could do the same thing.
You still make homemade tortillas?
Yes. I taught Becky, too. Becky makes good food, too.
You do the Christmas tamales also?
Yes. About 100 tamales every Christmas.
Wow.
Yes.
What time should I show up?
About 7 o'clock. We start early in the morning. I make my mole the day before, but it's been a tradition. We make tamales. I follow my mother's tradition. Every year she made them, well, since we were little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you said back when you were 3 years old. I mean, that's in the 1920s.
And yeah.
Those early years for you are the years that America was in the Great Depression.
And very bad.
You were one of 8 siblings.
Yes.
What do you remember about those years, and how did your family get by?
Well, like I say, my mother was ill. And my grandma lived with us, so they pulled their money together and did the cooking together. And we had a old house, big house, and the kids were all piled up, you know, sleeping together, and we were happy. My father worked shift, day shift, night shift, and trying to keep us quiet when Dewey's trying to sleep. So I remember a lot of that. My mother had epilepsy, and I remember when she fell over a couple of times when I was little. Of course, it scared me, but we got used to it. But we were a happy family.
And I always talk to people in your age group, and I'm always fascinated by how different life was back then. But especially for women, for young girls.
Mm-hmm.
The world was a very different place compared to 2020.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember having some ideas of, hey, when I grow up someday, I might do this or that?
Yeah, I wanted to be a nurse. I wanted to be a nurse to take care of sick people because my grandmother was a midwife, and I went everywhere with her. She delivered a lot of kids there, a lot of kids. I didn't know what was going on. I just saw her get some rubber gloves and let's go. And I'd go with her, and I didn't know what she was doing, you know, but she was delivering children. She delivered all of us. And she told me what to do, but I learned a lot from her. I was very attached to her.
And how about your siblings? You got 8 kids in the house, and you said you're all sleeping practically on top
of
each other.
Oh, yeah. Well, my sister, Allison, Connie, and me slept in one bed, and I used to say, don't touch me. Just a double bed with 3 people in it, you know, don't touch me. Of course, I'd start screaming, and I was very thin, very, very sickly, too. I was anemic, had a bleeding nose all the time. I was cross-eyed. I was sickly, and I hated school. I hated school.
Why is
that? I was in the sunshine class because it was a special class for skinny kids. And that was me. I was sickly.
So they called it the sunshine class because you guys needed vitamin D from the sun?
Yes, and cod liver oil every day.
I guess it worked.
I think it worked. It stayed in me because I'm 95.
That's what I'm saying. And everyone can hear how sharp you are and how with it you are. So you hated school.
I hated it. The only thing I liked was the spelling.
Oh, yeah?
I was good at that. I do crossword puzzles.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, my spelling was, I loved it.
We get into your teenage years. You're going to high school?
Yeah, up to the 11th grade only. I started working in the cannery. Friends of mine started quitting school and working, and they says, we're making 75 cents an hour. So I says, I want to try it. So I did. And my mother got mad because she wanted me to go to school, and the truant officer came looking for me. And I says, no, I'm going to work. So I quit school.
What kind of cannery was that?
Asparagus in Daniel, California. The bus would take us.
There's a day that unfolded in there somewhere. I guess it would have been right before your 17th birthday, a month before, December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that?
The war?
Yeah, Pearl Harbor.
Roosevelt was president, I know, and my father was very upset. But other than that, I don't remember too much more about that.
You know, I've heard over the years from people who lived in the Bay Area at that time that there were curfews, you had to black out your windows because people thought the Japanese may come there.
Well, the thing is this, on July 17, 1944, my father and mother had come to Fresno to look for a house because we were going to move. And in Port Chicago, about 10 miles from Pittsburgh, there was a big blow up, a big ship blew up.
Yeah.
And we could see it from our yard.
Wow.
The sky all red. And I lived in an Italian neighborhood. And the ladies out there were screaming that the Japanese had bombed us.
Wow.
But it didn't happen. No, it's just something that just happened over there. So I remember that July 17, 1944.
And back before that, with, you know, when Pearl Harbor happened, were your friends talking about this? Do you remember, you know, life changing where you lived at all after that?
Yeah, they started building a Camp Stoneman for soldiers there. It was a depot to go overseas. My father didn't like the idea of us living there with all those soldiers back and forth in the neighborhood. But they put a stop to them coming to the neighborhood. There was a lot of robberies and stuff. So he didn't like staying there. He didn't like living there. He wanted to come to Fresno.
When we talk about World War II, we talk about the soldiers. We talk about the sailors and the Marines and the airmen. But all the things that they were operating, the ships, the planes, the tanks, those really all had to be built. We didn't have those sitting around before the war started. And you and your family were very involved in building ships. Where, how did that start?
My father was working at the steel mill, and he had some friends who told him that they were hiring at the shipyards in Richmond, California, about 35, 40 miles away. And so he went and he got the job, quit the steel mill. And him and my brother went and they started working there. And they told us that we should go and try to get a job there. So my sisters and I went with them and we applied. And they said, yes, they want to be welders. They put us to welding school and I didn't like it because I think it was too heavy. The hood, everything. I says, I don't like this one bit. So he says, okay, you can be a burner. It's easier. So that's how we started. That was in November of 1943. And we worked till July of 1944. All that time, building those ships. Getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, being there by 7, and working till 4 in the afternoon. They had three shifts going. A lot of people. There was hardly any men because they were all drafted. Mm-hmm. A lot of women and old people. Old men and all women, mostly.
Would your whole family work the same shift?
No, we'd all go. My father would drive us. He had a 1939 Mercury. And, you know, gas was rationed then. My father had to get stamps to put gas in the car. because we were working in the shipyards, he got extra stamps.
Mm-hmm.
That was hard. Meat was stamped, too. Yeah, everything was rationed. He had to put the shades down. It was hard, very hard. And he would drive us in the morning. My mother would get up and make lunches for all of us. Or sometimes we'd buy the hot lunch there, half asleep, you know. And we didn't wear no clothes. Levi's and sweatshirts and flannel shirts and boots. That was my wardrobe all the time.
Were you ever concerned that you couldn't do that job?
No. I liked being around people. I'd like to be out in the with everybody, you know, learning. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't hard work at all. Just carry the settling with you and you hook it up and, you know, do what you have to do.
Well, yeah, and I want to understand this process. But first of all, what kind of ships were you guys building?
Liberty ships. You're working three shifts very fast. Before you know it, was up. My father and brother were riggers. They would just tell the crane guy over here, you know, they wore helmets. So, yeah, my sisters were welders. They were spotters. They would put the seam together and the horseshoe like this and weld it. And then I would come and burn it out. That was my job. But it was fun. It was fun. We were making a lot of money.
Was that the Kaiser shipyards?
Kaiser, Richmond, Kaiser. There was three shipyards, two, and three. We worked at number two.
Five of you were going every day.
Every day.
You think there was any family that had more?
Oh, yeah. A lot of our friends were going. Their families were all going. Same setup. They work in a different yard, but everybody was trying to make a buck.
Did you understand the significance of what you guys were doing?
Yes, I did. Yeah, we were doing something good, and we were making money. All of a sudden, we got money, you know, do what we want to do. That's why we came to Fresno, and we bought the house here, my father and mother.
With the money earned at the shipyard?
Yes. My father and mother were married in Fresno.
Okay.
In 1921 at St. John's Church.
Wow.
They lived in Delray, so that they wanted to come back to Fresno because the soldiers were taking over the town over there. We decided to move to Fresno.
Did you have a lot of friends from school or family friends who were sent overseas, who were fighting in that war?
A lot of my class went. My sister's boyfriends went, and I had cousins who went, and neighbors. They all got drafted. A lot of Italian boys went, because it was Little Italy there, and we used to love to dance.
Yeah?
Oh, Glenn Miller. I got all his records. Yeah, they used to have street dances. Most of the neighbors knew how to dance. So that was a lot of fun.
So I'm trying to understand, you know, life at the shipyards. There's a ton of people there.
Mm-hmm.
You're working a long shift. You're working hard. How were you treated by everybody else there?
Very good. We had older guys who were our bosses. They treated us very nice. Don't lift that too much. Don't do this. Don't do that. You know, very nice. Because you're young, 18 years old. You know, you can lift anything.
And help me understand exactly what you did. You said you were carrying an acetylene torch around?
Yeah, carry it to the thing and then hook it up. And then when they needed any burning, I would take it over there and light it and do my idea. They called them horseshoes. And this was welding, and this was welding, holding this together. And I would have to take it out after the girls welded this.
All right.
So, yeah, and then I just toss it. They had a big bucket you toss it in. I had a boss that followed me around, helped me sometimes with the line. But it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Did you see people's attitudes toward women changing because of what you were doing, what all you ladies were doing?
Not really. I was just treated very nice. And then if you needed a rest to go to the bathroom, they had a policewoman in there saying you could only be here 10 minutes. They watched you.
They wanted you to be working.
Yeah, they want you out in the field again. Yeah.
You know, and I've interviewed quite a few soldiers, veterans, who were Mexican-American or of Hispanic descent. Some of them said they had no problems in the armed forces with discrimination.
Yeah.
And others felt it very severely that they were discriminated against or treated differently because of their ethnicity.
No.
You never dealt with any of that there.
I could speak Spanish and everything. If you spoke Spanish, I spoke Spanish to you. I wasn't ashamed of my language. Not at all.
What did you enjoy the most about your time as a Rosie?
Just being with the other women. I all had stories. My husband's overseas. My father's overseas, you know. Some were just alone because their husbands were gone. They thought they were doing their bit, too. I don't remember any of those ladies when I went to that thing because everybody's changed. Some of them worked in the shipyard with us, but everybody's changed so much. You don't remember who it was, you know. But, you know, every time they launched a ship, it was a lot of fun.
What would they do?
Oh, a lot of dignitaries came. They get the champagne bottle, whatever they do. And that was a lot of fun to watch. And then they had the shows. The USO shows, the Andrews sisters came, Bing Crosby came, you know, at our lunchtime. They had a little stage. We sit on the ground and they perform. And that was a lot of fun for an hour.
Well, I guess that right there shows you the importance of what you were doing, because that's the same treatment they gave the troops overseas, bringing Bing Crosby
USO,
or Bob Hope.
Yeah, when the Andrews sisters came, my father loved it. He loved it. But then we saw Bing Crosby and Bob Hope came too. But I didn't care for him, you know. His jokes didn't do anything for me. Yeah, but we knew the war was going on, and we had to keep the shades down and, you know, do what they told us to do. You were living in the dark, really. He was tired of it. He didn't want to stay there no more.
You might have kept working at the shipyards if he didn't move you here.
We could have kept working, because all my friends were still working. Girlfriends that we had, you know, they were still working. And then we moved here, and I lost contact, you know.
So you would have been here when VE Day and VJ Day came around?
Oh, yeah. I was working at the Al drugstore for less money.
Can you help us understand how big a deal that was when that war that had been going on for so long was finally over?
Oh, everybody was cheering. Everybody was so happy. We had a lot of soldiers here and there. There was a couple of camps here, and they used to come in. all drugstore. I used to work at the Fountain. They came with the uniforms, and everybody was hugging them. We were all happy. It was over with.
And none of your brothers ever got drafted or anything?
Oh, yeah. My three brothers all went. My brother Ernie got drafted first, and my brother Junior went in the Navy, and my brother Jerry got drafted in the Army. My sister Alice, her boyfriend, he was in Italy, and my sister Connie's boyfriend was in Germany. And I had friends in Pittsburgh, a lot of friends that had gone in the service, and a lot of them had passed away.
That was the reality during World War II when more than 406,000 Americans made that ultimate sacrifice. More than 16 million Americans served in uniform, and millions more were doing their part on the home front, just like Angie and her family were. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, what was it like for Angie to be honored at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Home Front National Historic Park? We're also going to hear from her daughter and her husband of 70 years, who has quite a story of his own to share. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a chance today to hear from someone who will soon be awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. In 2020, the nation's highest civilian honor went to survivors of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. In the future, the women who worked on the home front so men could fight overseas, America's legendary Rosie the Riveters, will receive that honor. Angie Schiappi of Clovis, California, is one of them. When she was a teenager, she would get up early every morning and ride with her father, her brother, and two sisters to the Kaiser Shipyards in Richmond, California, where she was a welder helping to put together Liberty ships. If you go to that same location today, you will find the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historic Park. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And Angie, I'm pretty sure that 76 years ago, when you fired up that acetylene torch for the final time, I bet you didn't expect what you and all those other Americans were doing to become such a celebrated part of our history.
You think about it.
How about when you go back there now to Richmond and to that museum and that historic park?
I'm amazed at the pictures and all. It brings so much memory back of all the ships we did, everything that happened. Everything's in black and white on the wall. I'm amazed. I didn't think I'd ever see it.
Did it give you a different perspective on the significance of what you did?
Yeah, it did. I've been there. I did that. Real happy.
Did you learn anything about the volume of ships that you produced or how quickly you turned them out?
I always wondered how many ships we did and how many sailors got killed. I always think, I wonder what happened. You know, I wonder what happened to the ship. And then, like I said, when I watched Hugh Hauser, he had all them all lined up, you know, and they were showing all the ships. I said, yeah, I remember that part. The hulls underneath. I remember all that.
So if somebody is listening right now and they say, hey, I want to go see this Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historic Park, and they head over to Richmond to check it out, what should they look for? What do you think they're going to get out of that experience?
They're going to see all, get a lot of memories. They're going to say, oh, my grandfather, oh, my knee, my uncle. I remember when I was little, my uncle did this, my uncle did that. They'll see all the sailors and pictures of army guys and nurses and And anybody who served, they'll see all that. Mm-hmm. That's all memories, good memories.
For someone who didn't live it, how would you explain the significance or the importance of you and all the other Rosies in the bigger picture of World War II and what ended up happening?
I always think about, where are they at now? You know, I've been there. I did that. I wonder what happened to these people. We were mm-hmm. so happy, so young, doing all this and all that. I never thought that I'd get this old to think about it and look back to see what I did. I'm glad I did it.
And why does it matter? What do you think you accomplished?
Because I put my 2 cents in. I did my thing. At least I did something.
And if you weren't all doing it, then it might not have had the same outcome.
No. Mm-mm. I think about all the Rosies that, you know, are gone. They did their bit.
It sounds like this is something that you're proud of.
Yes, I am. I'm proud of it, yeah. Looking back, I'm saying, how could I have done that? You know, how could I have done that, you know? I was wild, you know. 18 years old, you're raring to go.
You know, typically, I only talk to people who've served in our armed forces on this program. But over the years, people have recognized how significant Rosie the Riveters were mm-hmm. to that victory in World War II. But there is a veteran sitting here, too, and you've been married to him for the last 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
How did you and Vince meet?
When I was living in Fresno, working for a Dr. Tyner, chiropractor, and his father and mother used to come in for treatment. And he was in the service at the time, and he had an older brother. They used to bring them in for treatment. And one day the mother came in, and she says, my son's going to come home on leave. I want you to meet him. And I thought, well, I already had a boyfriend. And I thought, well, I don't know. And she says, when he comes, I'll bring him in, you meet him. And I said, oh, okay. When he came home on leave, he brought her to the doctor, and I met him. I says, that's for me. And I met him. And we started going out. He had his uniform. He was in service. Mm-hmm. I never thought I'd go out with a serviceman. That was in November. And December, for Christmas, we were still together. And he went back in January to Washington. And he says, if you marry me, I won't re-enlist. Will you marry me? I said, yes. So that's why he didn't re-enlist. He just went back from his leave. And he came home in February, and we were married a few months later.
And when you said, yeah, that's for me, what was it about him that made you so convinced?
I don't know if it was the uniform or it was him or what. That's what he looked like, you know.
I see his hair there on the wall, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I see a wedding picture, too.
Yeah.
We'll put that at hometownheroesradio.com. So you've been married 70 years.
In June.
That's a long time.
Yes, it sure is.
What's your secret?
He likes my cooking. I take good care of him. You know, I make sure that he eats his meals, he takes his medication. I mean, I've always been there for him, and he's been there for me.
You have 4 kids and 12 grandkids and 6 great-grandkids. I'm sure somewhere along the line they've asked you for some advice on how to stay married that long. Do you have some advice for people who want to catch up to you guys there at 70 years?
Not really. Just be patient. Be patient. Love each other. When you get married, I do, till the end. That's it. My father and mother were the same way. Grandma and Grandpa, too. I'm following their tradition.
I'm going to ask Vince some questions here in a minute, but I'm just wondering, since we're getting awfully close to Thanksgiving here, when you have the daughter of Mexican immigrants married to the son of Italian immigrants, what does Thanksgiving dinner look like?
Turkey. Every year, a turkey. I have all my grandkids here, my family. I cook a big turkey outside. And to this day, I'm still cooking. I make sure he gets 3 meals a day. Yeah, I love to cook. Don't take me away from the kitchen. If you do, bury me.
You're going to have a lot of people that want to come over for dinner after they hear this.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And Thanksgiving. It's right in the name.
Yeah.
It's about gratitude and counting our blessings. What are the things that you're thankful for?
Everything. My health, my kids, my husband, what I've got, everything. I do. I pray every day. Every morning, I sit at my desk, and I do a lot of novenas. I don't know if you know what they are, mm-hmm. but I do a lot of rosaries, a lot of prayers, and I just thank God that I woke up.
What would you say you're most proud of?
My kids, my husband, my family. I love my family.
That family includes her daughter, Becky Pattison, to whom Angie has passed the Thanksgiving dinner torch as far as cooking responsibilities go. Not to be confused with an acetylene torch, of course. And speaking of, Becky, how has your understanding of the significance of your mom's Rosie the Riveter days developed over the years?
My aunt had been going to the Rosie the Riveter celebrations every year, and she kept on trying to get my mom to go. And I don't think my mom knew the significance of being a Rosie. It was her job, and that's how she took it until we finally got her forcibly to go with us to the Rosie thing. My dad told her, she goes, it's like me being in the military. He goes, it was my job, but that we celebrate being in the military now and going on the honor flight. So he goes, this is your honor flight, going to the Rosie celebration. And so once she got there, I think she realized what a significant, I mean, I'm being a woman. I am very proud of my mom doing, being a Rosie, and my aunts, because I had two aunts that did it too. And she always downplayed it. She never thought it was no big deal. Oh yeah, I worked in the shipyard. It's no big deal. And then I think as my Aunt Connie started going to the celebrations, my cousins kept going. She goes, Becky, you need to come. So I actually went by myself the year before, and I go and celebrate it with my Aunt Connie. And I go, oh my God, I got to get my mom here. I go, to have two sisters that worked in the shipyard together, I go, that has to be unique, that they are still alive, mm-hmm. and they actually had their spouses them with them. I mean, that has to be very unique.
What's something about your parents that people who haven't met them should know about them?
They respect each other. I mean, they might have their differences and stuff, but they do respect each other. What she can't do, he does, and what he can't do, she does. So they make a good balance with each other. When I was little, they used to try to embarrass all my friends, so...
How's that?
They used to like to dance in the middle of the kitchen floor, just no music, but they would just start dancing.
Gazing into each other's eyes?
Uh-huh. Just to see the reaction of my friends or whoever that was over there.
I think I know what I need to have them do before I leave.
You know, when you're younger, you're going, no big deal. But as I grow older, I realize that I'm very proud of my parents and very proud that they served. My dad served. I mean... And then my mom was a Rosie. I'm just very proud of them. And it makes me sad that America's in this uproar that it is. And hopefully we unite a little bit better.
Words we can all take to heart. So we've heard from Angie and daughter Becky, but I also want you to hear from Becky's dad, Angie's husband of 70 years, Vince Schiappi. Vince, you heard what Angie had to say about the key to staying married for 70 years. So you have a response or a rebuttal for that?
Well, I pretty much agree with her on her food. I love her food. She's the best cook in town. I think she should have opened up a restaurant. Her first name is Angie, so I think Angelina would be nice. Angelina's Taqueria or something in that order, you know, yeah. Mexican restaurant. She knows how to make the beans.
Give us the menu here. What are your favorites that she's made over the years?
Well, chili verde, I love that. And she makes a pile of that all the time, and tortillas and beans and rice. She watches over me like I'm a little baby, you know. She does everything for me except feed me a baby bottle, you know. And so I'm grateful for that and everything that a man wishes, I think. And so she's great. She's a good wife, good woman.
Let's talk about your background a little bit. So I mentioned her parents were immigrants from Mexico. Your parents came over from Italy in the 1920s?
Yeah, 1923, I believe it was. It was right after World War I. My dad was in the Italian Army at that time. When the World War I was over, you know, all the servicemen came home and all that, from what he was telling me. And there was no jobs. Everybody was just down and out. The whole world just went to heck. So he met my mother. First, her sister came with her husband to Quincy, Massachusetts. They were building a house back there. He was a mason. So my mother and father, you know, they said, well, go ahead, we'll sign for you to come here to America and buy a boat ticket and come on over. So they came over and they moved in with my aunt and uncle. And my father helped my uncle build his house there in Quincy, Massachusetts. So finally, they decided they moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and that's where I was born. I had two brothers. Actually, I had three. One passed away when he was about 2 years old, and then I come along. Mm-hmm. And I was the fourth one. All boys. My mother kept saying, gee, I want a girl. You know, I want a girl, you know. And finally, that was it, no more. But my brother died of pneumonia. In those days, they didn't have the medical knowledge that they have now. And he was 2 years old, I believe. And I was 6 months old when he died. But my other two brothers, of course, they were older. My brother John and my brother Frank. And that's a picture of them.
All in uniform.
All in uniform. That's Frank in the middle. That's John on the left. And John on the left was in the Pacific during World War II. And my brother Frank, he was in Europe in Germany and France and over there. And, of course, that's me. I was in during the Korean War time. And with them being older, of course, they went in during the war.
So you're a little boy growing up with two older brothers. What was kind of your outlook? Did you have some ideas of, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do?
I was on the run all the time. I was a brat. And not having two older brothers around, with them being in the service, them being 4, 5, 6 years older, they had other ideas, you know. So I was pretty much by myself with my parents, you know. So I was just, whatever happened, happened.
Was that hard for you to have your brothers overseas and worry about whether they would come back?
I thought about them all the time. I was well aware of World War II. I was into it. I would read up on it a lot. At those days, everything was black and white. You go to the movies, and they would have that in between the main feature and another feature. They would have a news kind of a thing, and they would show Europe, Pacific, guns shooting off and everything. And I was fascinated, or just, it was, I was in awe over all those things, you know. And then I would think of my brothers, and I know they were in the middle of it, but they came out good.
Did it seem to you that they were changed by the war from how they were before they left and when they came back?
Oh, yeah. They were so mature when they came home. I couldn't believe it. When we were together at home, I would always look up to them like, here's this big man here, you know. They came home in their uniforms, you know. I was real proud of them. I was just in awe all the time, and I just couldn't believe that they were so much bigger than me, you know, and I was always looking up to them as my big brothers. I was very proud of them. I remember when the war started, when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. In those days, it was just radio, TV. They never heard of such a thing, you know, cell phones and computers. That was something you just never heard of. My father, I remember him talking to my mother. He says, you know, they may draft me. He was already an American citizen. He became an American citizen back in the 30s after he was here about 10 years, and then he became an American citizen, and my mother. And I remember him telling her, and my mother started crying. So I thought of it later on, and I started crying about it, you know. I said, gee, my dad's got to go to the war. Being a young kid, all I knew was war meant death. And I said, I'm going to lose my father. I'll never forget that. I can see myself right there at that time. I was telling one of the other kids, the neighbor kids, and I said, my dad's going to go to war. And they looked at me like, I could still see their faces, like, so what? You know, what's that? They didn't know any more than I did what a war was all about. We already served in the Italian army. Come to find out later, he was too old to go in, so they rejected him. So we were all worried about that for a while, because I remember him telling my mother, no, no, in Italian. I understood Italian. They said, no, I'm too old.
His father was too old, and young Vinny, as his brothers called him, was too young. Or was he? Wait until you hear how old he was when he lied his way into the army. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You heard from Angie Schiappi, one of America's Rosie the Riveters during World War II. And now we're hearing from her husband of 70 years, Vince, who spent 3 years in the U.S. Army. He had to lie about his age to get in, but before we get to that, you were a boy, Vince, with your brothers off serving in World War II. So I wonder if you remember what it was like for your parents to have two sons risking their lives overseas.
Oh, my mother cried and all the time. She would write letters to my brothers. They would write back, and then she would read them to me. It would be half Italian, half English. Brought up in an Italian family like that, I was able to understand a lot of it. I couldn't write it. I could understand their language from their part of Italy. And she'd sit down, and she'd read it to me and all that, and then she'd write back and everything. And
were your brothers the reason that you got into the Army?
I was 15.
15?
Yes. 15 and a half. My mother signed me off. Get rid of this kid. Get him out of here. He's
all
on
right.
the run.
Give me the whole story now. What what was going on here?
Yeah, 47 I went in.
47. So you're 15 and a half. And what, you're just so much trouble they wanted you out of the house?
I wasn't bad trouble. I was just, I like to be on my own. I'm still the same way. I went to barber school in Boston, and I enjoyed it and graduated and all that. And I still cut her hair, you know, I know how to do it.
Right.
So, but anyway, not getting into a lot of trouble or anything like that. I just like to go wherever I wanted to go. I'd take off from Cambridge, go to Boston all by myself and go to the beach there or wherever, you know, under the Charles River and MIT, go to the college there and just wander around, you know, just a juvenile that shouldn't be doing things like that, you know.
So you weren't fond of school?
I wasn't fond of school at all. When I was there, I would learn. I just didn't like being trapped.
So you're 15 and a half years old. How old did you have to be to get in the Army?
17, I think it was.
If you were 17, your parents could sign for you and they'd let you in. So how did you pull this off to convince the Army that you were actually 17 when you were 15 and a half?
My mother signed for me and set a different age.
Did she like forge a birth certificate or a baptism record or something?
You know, in those days when I went in 47, they didn't check so much on a lot of things. And they were coming out of the service from the war, World War II. So they needed to fill those spots with new people. I said, heck yeah, I'll go. You know, and to me it was an adventure. I thought, hey, this would be nice, be on my own and not realizing you got to go by the rules. When you're in the Army, buddy, they make it tough on you if you don't. But I liked it. I really did. I told them I was born in 1928, you know, when I was really born in 31. So that put me at 17. And a recruiting sergeant just signed the papers and everything. Okay, come on back. We'll swear you in next week. Put my hand up. I swore in. Away I went.
Did anybody ever figure it out?
No.
Did anyone ever think you were too young?
No, no. I had that young look, I think, but being a recruit, just going in, we were all young. Everybody was older than me. Actually, there was about four or five others from Texas that was my age or maybe a year older, something like that, and they found out about them, and they released them. I don't know what happened to them, but I know they weren't in my barracks no more.
Well, that had to get your attention.
Yes, it did. I was a little worried. I thought, oh, I'm going to prison. I thought, oh, they're going to shoot me. They're going to the firing squad is waiting for me, uh-huh. You know. And I didn't say nothing. I remember the sergeant saying in the barracks there, he says, anybody else in this barracks, you know? I just kept quiet, and I didn't say nothing. And I just coasted right through.
Tell me some of the things you did in the Army.
Going through training in Fort Ord, California. From there, we went on a ship up the coast of California to Washington, into the Puget Sound there, to a little base there, a little island, about 7 miles long, I remember. It was 4 miles wide. And we had a training, and there was about 200 servicemen. So we were training there on LCVs and LCMs, uh-huh. Landing crafts.
So you're an amphibious unit?
36 okay. combat engineers.
Uh-huh.
So we were training on that. We had some old junker boats. The captain said, there they are. Tear them down, put them back together. And we had some bulldozers there that we'd pull them out of the water and work on them, and had some old junker tools and just rip the engines apart, and whatever needed fixing, we'd put it together and push them back out in the water with the bulldozer and
just float around.
And then we knew that we were going to get new equipment when we had to go overseas. So we were just training on that. And that was good. I liked that.
But before you went overseas, there was something that actually happened on the West Coast that you guys responded to. And I'm thinking about recently, California's awful wildfires. The president actually awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross to some men who flew their helicopters in when they were told not to and saved people's lives. You were part of a different kind of natural disaster in the response to it.
They had a big hurricane that came into Oregon in the lower part of Washington. It just flooded the whole area, all that into the Columbia River. It's just south of Washington and the upper part of Portland, Oregon. The Columbia River comes in there through all those towns and everything. Because we had these flat bottom LCVPs and LCMs with a ramp in the front, they were the kind that would hit the beach and the troops would come out and storm the beach and invade. Anyway, they sent two of our boats. There was a three-man boat. It was the coxswain, the seaman, and the mechanic. And I was a seaman at that time. Anyway, the captain said, we need two boats to go down. And who wants to go? And I put my hand up. I didn't know where the heck we were going. Mm-hmm. I knew we had a big storm that had come in because it affected us up there in Washington. But they got hit hard. It was about 2 days after the storm had finally turned around and went back out to the ocean. It just flooded that whole area.
Was it Vanport? Was that the town?
Yeah. Anyway, we came down the ocean from upper Washington. I don't know how many miles that is, but it's got to be at least a few hundred miles. Went in there and said, what do we do? You know, we just asked people who just trying to save themselves with the water. The water was up to the eaves, to the windows, and the people on roofs. And so they say, just go out there and pick up people. So we went up and down the streets and picking up people and babies and just families and whoever needed help, you know. And we'd have maybe 20, 30 people at a time in a boat. Take them back to dry land, to a dock or someplace. And by then, the Red Cross had come in and a few other people, and were serving people food and coffee and whatever. And we would just go out there and do whatever. We were just on our own, just two boats. We had packed up a bunch of sea rations. We had about maybe, six, seven cases of sea rations in our boat, just eating out of cans, whatever was in that box, and cigarettes and whatever they put in there. Finally, they started serving meals, and we were picking up a little food. But we were picking up people all the time and bringing them back into dry land, and then they'd find their own way from then on. You know, in my boat, I think, I would say we picked up on my boat alone about 200 people. The water was just came in from the ocean, from the storm and everything, and it just flooded miles and miles of all into the Columbia River. It just went over the banks, went over everything. So we spent about 2 weeks there and just living out. Well, we'd go in and we made sure, because our boats were flat bottom, we could tread water about maybe 3 feet, mm-hmm. you know, 2-3 feet, something like that. But then it got so that water started pushing out to the ocean, so we started backing off. And after about a week or so, people were finding their way around by then. I don't remember ever picking up anybody that was injured. Mostly everybody was just standing on their porches or on the second floor or somewhere on roofs and just waiting, you know, save us, help us, you know. So I was real proud of myself then. I was actually, to me, it was fun. They were in trouble, them people. Yeah. They were in real bad trouble.
What would have happened to them if you guys weren't there?
I'm sure somebody would have died. I'm sure of that. Because there was a lot of them. Not just some, there was a lot that was just coming out of the second floor windows, just hanging out the windows there, and we'd just drive right up alongside there, and they'd climb in our boat, and we'd take them to dry land, and the Red Cross would greet them and take over from there. And all they had was their children, their dog, whatever, their cat. But anyway, we spent 2 weeks there, and finally they sent a couple of soldiers down to see what was going on with us, because we didn't have no communication with them. We didn't have no radios, no telephones, no nothing. We didn't know the telephone, that the basis phone, nothing, you know. So we were just sitting there all by ourselves. We could have still been there, you know. Finally, they located us, and they said, hey, the captain wants you to come back, you know. You're not on vacation. So we loaded up our gear, whatever we had, and we just had a few pair of pants and a couple of shirts and things like that. And it was cold. I remember that. It was very cold. And up there, it's always raining all the time. Finally, we got some fuel That was our worry, that we were going to run out of fuel, because we have two engines in those boats, and they just eat up the fuel like crazy. So we managed to get some fuel from a gas station that didn't get too much water. So we filled up our tanks and took off. We never paid them. So they never got it. I don't know how they got their money back on it, but we had no money. You know, sure. We had no money. We had no place to spend it. Everything was underwater.
It's got to be a surreal feeling to see all that.
It was something, and I think I was telling you earlier about a cow that we picked up.
So you picked up 200 people and one cow.
And one cow. We went out just outside of town there, and there was this cow out there all by himself, and the water was up to his belly. And he was just standing there just looking at us, and we slowed all the way down to just a crawl there. And we thought, well, we'll lower the ramp, and we can see if we can shoo him onto the ramp and get him into the boat. And we were just about maybe 30 feet away from him. All of a sudden, he just walked up into the ramp there and walked into the boat like, and we didn't coach him in or nothing, just like as if we had a rope around his neck, you know. And we lifted the ramp and we took off about maybe a couple of miles away, and we found some dry land and put the ramp down and just turned them loose. So I guess whoever owned them found them eventually. I know he had a big band around his neck, so he probably had a number or something. And it was the craziest thing. We laughed about that all the time. That crazy cow, you know, he he wasn't so crazy. He knew he wanted out of there, you know. So, but anyway, that it was an experience. But anyway, we went back up to Washington, went back to base and reported in. And the captain says, hey, go back to work. You know what you have to do. Get down to the motor pool and check in and go to work. Mm-hmm. Okay. We never got recognized for it. Never, no thank you, no nothing. You
know? And there were only two boats?
Two boats.
For the whole operation?
Yeah. There was other people on rafts or little skiffs, I guess you call them, local people that had little boats of some kind, fishing boats and things like that. And they were picking up people. But they liked us because we could pick up a lot, and we were flat bottom, and we could just pull right up alongside of a house, and people would climb on.
Have you ever had a chance to see any of those people again?
No, never. I think about it all the time that I would like to go up there and just drive around for a couple, 3 days, you know, and just look over the area.
So there were only six of you that participated in that?
Yeah.
Do you know if the other guys are still around?
I have no idea. I can't even remember what they look like now.
And how long did you stay in the service?
3 years, 47 to 50.
She said the first time she met you, she said, I've got to have that. I think that was the quote, right? That's for me. That's what you said. What about you? What do you remember about meeting her?
I went to her job. Yeah, she had a white uniform on. She was a nurse assistant, doctor's assistant. And I thought, hey, you know, I'll go out with her. It's a date. You know, I'm home on leave. I had a 30-day leave. I met her. I thought, that's a pretty girl here, you know. So let's go out. You know, let's go have a good time. Go have dinner or whatever. And I don't even remember what we did, where we went.
Oh, she remembers. Probably remembers the date.
What
you were wearing. Uh-huh. So, but anyway, we went out a few times after that, and I said, she's a nice girl. So we wrote back and forth, and then I went back, and I was due to get out of the service a few months later. So when I got out, I came to Fresno, and we started dating. I wanted to re-enlist because being a loner, I enjoyed the Army when I was in. So I wanted to go back in, and I asked her, you know, if I go back in, will you follow me, you know? And she was, maybe yes, maybe no, you know. I mean, how do you tell a girl like this, you know? She don't know what to expect, you know. I'm in the service, and maybe I'm overseas, and maybe she's here all by herself, and she don't know what's going on, you know. So it ended up, I stayed out, and that was it. I thought I was going back in there for a while because everything was getting hot and heavy in Korea. I didn't register right away when I got out. You're supposed to register within 30 days. I don't know why I didn't do it, but after a few months, I said, you know, I better get down there. So I went down and I registered at the county office and everything. And then they finally got a hold of me and they says, you know, we've been looking for you. I says, what? I said, well, you got my address. You know where I live, right over here on Kearney Boulevard with my parents. Why were you looking for me? He said, well, you know, you're just fresh out of the service. We don't have to retrain you.
Right.
We want you right back in, give you your rank back and all that. I was a sergeant. I told her, I said, goodbye. And I said, I don't know where this is going. So we got married, and then they deferred me. They said, well, because you're married, we're not going to bring you in, but you're on hold. We may still call you back. So I says, okay. And they never did.
So you might have been landing troops at Incheon or something if you hadn't gotten married.
Yeah. She tells me that once in a while.
She saved your life by marrying you?
She saved my life. She tells me that. She says, you know, we got married. She says, you'll be dead over there, I'll bet. My best friend over there, Earl, his name was Earl. Earl Stiles, big, tall, lanky kid. He had gone into the World War II right at the end. And he was over in China and over in that area. And he was fighting the guerrillas over there. But anyway, he got captured. He died in the POW camp. And I kept writing to him, and I couldn't get an answer. And I finally knew his home address in Council Bluff, Iowa. So I wrote there, and his mother wrote back and said, we have no idea where he's at. He's missing in action. So about 2 years later, she wrote me that he died in a POW camp. Malnutrition, dysentery, she told me. They weren't feeding him. They were no medication, no nothing. You know, I don't know how many died. And I was surprised. I says, how did he get captured? You know, I mean, he wasn't the kind of a guy that you capture. But when you got a gun pointing at your forehead, you put your hands up. That's it.
Do you know if they ever brought him home or no?
Yes, they brought him home. He's buried there in Council Bluff, Iowa. I've told her a few times, yeah, I'd love to go back to the cemetery and see him. We're barroom buddies, you know. We go out on pass and have our beer and stuff like that. And we want to open up our own little bar when we get out, you know. And
yeah.
We were making plans. I was sure sorry about that. And then the rest of the guys in my platoon, they got captured, died, or got killed somehow. I just never kept track of them.
So there's a good chance you would have been captured or killed.
I always wanted to go back and see the Capitol, and especially the Korean War Memorial, to see the graves and, you know, and all the monuments and different things like that. And I said, here's my fellow brothers here. And I really enjoyed myself there. And of course, my daughter took care of me. The on-the-flight people like you, we were number one. You people were great with us. But that Korean Memorial, I loved it. That was my thing.
I don't want to leave anything out if there's something that's important to you, but I want to say thank you for serving our country. When you think about Thanksgiving, what is it that you're most thankful for?
I'm thankful for being an American. I thank my mother and father for coming here to this great country. I don't know how it would have been if I was born in Italy, and of course I would have been a young kid during World War II over there. I don't know if I would have survived, but I'm mostly thankful that I'm here and meeting my wife and having the family that I have. Like Angie says, we have four adopted children, and we're proud of that. Us not being able to have children, that was the route that we took. And here we are, still married 70 years later, got a nice home. I'm not rich, I'm comfortable, and I'm proud that I served for my country. Maybe I didn't do as much as the other guy that got wounded or got killed or something. I feel for them that did get wounded and got killed. I feel great sorrow for their mothers and fathers. I had my first cousin that got shot down coming back from Germany in a B-24 from Africa. That was their base. They went over to bomb Germany over there, and they got hit by aircraft fire, and they were making their way back on fire, from what I was told, and they couldn't make it, and they crashed in Africa. And that was in 1944, and they didn't find the plane until 1952. I remember my aunt, she had to go back. She was living with my mother out here in California, and so she had to go back, and they brought his body back, you know. Matthew DeLuca was his name.
That picture on the wall of you and 70 other veterans at the World War II Memorial. Behind you is a wall of gold stars, 406,000 Americans in World War II, and one of those hit really close to home for you.
That's right. And I think of him. I think of him a lot. I remember when I was young, he used to throw me up on his shoulders. He was a tall, lanky guy. I used to look at his arms, and he was just all muscle. He'd throw me, come on, Vinzine. He called me Vinzine for Vincent. He'd throw me up on his shoulders, and I thought, gee, this guy's really sharp, boy. I really enjoyed him, you know. He was like a brother to me, you know. And so when he got killed, anyway, they found their bodies, you know, in Africa in the jungles. The natives or somebody, I don't know who it was, but they ID'd him with their dog tags. Anyway, yeah, that was close. He was close to me, but I was thankful, again, I say, for my brothers for coming back. They made it, and I made it. I have 2, 3, 4, 5 flags, American flags, hanging out off of my house right now. One on my lawn, 2 on the side here, and 2 off the garage doors. And they're there all the time. I salute them every day. This is my country. There ain't no other country that's like this country. And I'm proud that I serve for my fellow Americans.
Hey, one more question about Angie. With her being a Rosie, what does that mean to you?
Oh, I'm very proud of her.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of her. In those days, the women, they kept the home front going. With all the men over there, of course, they had the women's corps, too. They did very well. They had no combat stuff like they do now, but nurses and whatever else. But they had to have somebody here in the shipyards, you know, just building whatever had to be built for the war front. And she was part of that. And I'm proud of her for doing that, you know. She did her part during World War II. You know, being a young girl, a ship is a ship. A boat is a boat, you know. All she knew is she had to weld something together, you know, and that was it, and go home and eat, come back to work, you know. But not knowing really what the war front was like. But I'm very proud of her for what she did.
America is proud of her. Soon, Angie and all the other Rosie the Riveters will receive the Congressional Gold Medal for their efforts all those years ago. We're out of time here on the radio, but there are a few more memories from the Chiappe family and the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also find a short video of Vince and Angie dancing like they have through 70 years of marriage. I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving with your family if you're able to gather together. I know I am beyond thankful for the privilege of meeting all these amazing Americans and sharing all of their stories with you. And if you're like me, you never get tired of being reminded that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.